Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? We're now approaching the third session. In the first session, we talked about some of the creedal developments. In the second session, we spoke about some of the opinions, philosophical opinions of Ibn Taymiyyah, and we were able to contrast them with some of those opinions of the philosophers, in particular Ibn Sina and others. And today we're going to be looking at Al-Ghazali, who needs no introduction at all. I mean, this scholar is potentially one of the, you could argue, I'm not going to say the most, obviously, because we've got, you know, the companions and the Tabi'in and so on. But in his era, he's certainly the biggest scholar of his era. And one of the biggest scholars of Islam. Why? Because Al-Ghazali was an individual who was mutafannin. He was an individual who was able to put his hands in more than one subject matter, and he was able to master more than one subject matter. For example, as we mentioned before, he wrote Al-Mustasfa, which is a book on Usul Fiqh, which can be argued to be the most important book on Usul Fiqh there is. Could be argued. And he also wrote extensively, as you guys know more than me, on Fiqh. And he was authoritative in Shafi'i Fiqh. You know, a master of Shafi'i Fiqh. Maybe not, obviously, as same level as, you know, a Nawawi. I'm right here, right? Really, yeah? Okay. Well, and the Shafi'is go back to him for the Mu'tamad and stuff, right? So, but certainly his ability to extrapolate was on the same level as the big guys there. So he was fiqh as well. And then obviously he aqidah, which is a creed, and kalam. And then you had, obviously, and this is something which can be seen as an ilm, mustaqil in and of itself, is tazkiyah, or tasawwuf, or whatever you want to call it, which is the idea of purification. And Ihya al-Umuddin is probably the most compendious and the most famous spiritual textbook in all of Islam. I don't think there's anything like it. And I'll be honest with you, I've seen some nusakh of it recently. Some Salafis have dealt with it in a certain way, because there are some weak hadiths and whatever. They've taken out these hadiths, so that even there's a Salafi-friendly version of it, if you like. And I think it's a great shame for people who maybe feel fearful to indulge in the works of Kalam, of Al-Ghazali, not to explore this janib. Because he really, you can see that he's going into very deep experiential detail from his own experience and stuff like that. And in fact, a lot of his kutub, Ihya al-Umuddin, has been translated into English. And there's books that you can buy. Obviously, it's a big collection. But for example, the Book of Love, Kitab al-Mahabba, Kitab al-Muhasaba, the Book of Accountability. Very nice little things. And I've mentioned before, I think the best, in terms of, from my experience, and obviously people can recommend in the comment section, or you guys can recommend to me, where I was recommended at the beginning of guidance, Bidayatul Hidayah, which is a very nice introductory book. When I first read it, and it's been translated into English as well. Beginning of guidance is in English, yeah? When I first read it, it really put me in my place, because he has this tone where it's not too assertive, but it's assertive enough to put you in your place. Like, he's just laying out the facts. It's not as you think it is. Like, people, when they associate spirituality, they think a spiritual textbook is a textbook that speaks, you know, in a way which someone's on some kind of drug would speak. Like, someone's high or something. No, but he's speaking in a way which is quite discipline-orientated way. He's teaching you how to discipline yourself on a daily basis and how to fix your intentions and these kinds of things. So if someone wants a handy introduction to Al-Ghazali, and from a spiritual perspective, I think this is the place to start. And then go to Ihya al-Umuddin and start with these kutub, the small ones. And they've been translated into English, like Kitab al-Muhasaba, Kitab al-Mahabba, and these kinds of books. Kitab al-Ilm, and so on. In terms of scholars in the Western world, I think I've mentioned him to you before. Frank Griffel is probably the best one that has dealt with Al-Ghazali. Like, and he's got books on him and stuff like that. Today we're going to be focusing on Al-Ghazali's arguments against infinity. Okay, now this is there's two arguments I would say are the most important in terms of unique contribution of Al-Ghazali and the Ash'ari school in particular. Number one is this arguments against infinity, and the second one is takhsis, or particularization. One book I would recommend, which I think is probably the best one I've read in the English language, is a book called Proofs of Eternity by Herbert Davidson. Herbert Davidson was a Jew, but he was fluent in the Arabic language and the Hebrew language. And I personally feel like that book was probably the best treatment in the English language of these kinds of arguments. But it's an advanced book, like, so you'd have to kind of have some level of understanding of what's going on. But it's, that is probably the go-to. If someone wants to have like a overview, synoptic overview of like which each thinker thought about these proofs of eternity, about eternity and proofs of God's existence, this is probably the best book, you know. So it's important to start by saying that Al-Ghazali wrote many books and on philosophy, but the one we're going to be focusing on today, or there's a few, but the main one is Tahafut al-Falasifa, or the translated into The Incoherence of the Philosophers, which has been translated into English language. In it, he offers arguments against Ibn Sina, who was an eternalist. Now, before I continue, what did Ibn Sina believe about the universe and eternality? Who knows? Okay, and what? How did he articulate that? Do you remember?
Exactly how he argued for it.
Yeah, or how, what were the kinds of analogies that he put forward, if you remember?
It was the emanation theory.
Yes,
so
okay.
He spoke about Allah as like the sun, and then the universe as its rays.
So yeah.
As long as the sun is there, then the rays are there.
Exactly, and this would indicate, I mean, let's use this very analogy, right? If you have the sun and then you have the rays of the sun, does the sun choose to emanate its rays?
No,
it doesn't. Yeah. So what does Ibn Sina believe about Allah's will?
So that was the problem. Like he basically took away the will of Allah.
Like yeah. He didn't believe God had a will like that.
Yeah.
So this is actually very dangerous. It's like, you know, and important, because these are the two points. Emanationism, eternalistic emanationism, number one. And number two, the fact that God doesn't have a will that Al-Ghazali famously attacked Ibn Sina for. And it was such a famous attack that, like, if you're into reading Ibn Taymiyyah's books and stuff like that, you'll see, like, for example, Sharh Aqidah Isfahaniyah, Ibn Taymiyyah is like, and this has already been refuted, like, in relation to these kinds of theories, and one can refer to the great Sheikh Al-Ghazali. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, because of the atmosphere that we're living in, the attitude that the Atharis had, even the most polemical of them, with Al-Ghazali, was very respectful. Like Al-Dhahabi, Hujjat al-Islam, called him the proof of Islam. You know, like Ibn Taymiyyah, al-Shaykh al-Fadil, and so on. So we'll start with what Ibn Sina thought. So he said, as you mentioned, that God is eternal, God is necessary. Yeah, God is eternal, God is necessary. And whatever comes from him is also necessary. And whatever comes from him doesn't come from him through will, but it comes from him through necessity. And Ibn Sina also believed that, so therefore God doesn't have a will. Yeah. He also said something else which is quite odd, which is that since God is one, only singular things can come from God. لا يصدر من الواحد إلى الواحد. I'm not sure if you've heard of this before. He believed that because God is one, multiplicitous things cannot emerge from him. Only singular things can emerge from him one time, because something bereft of a quality cannot produce it. Do you see the point? Obviously, that if we're talking about the will of God, if God has the will and the power to do something, and creation, we can argue against it. So the only way you can argue against this kind of theory is through takhsis and through establishing the will of God. So this shows you how important it is to establish the will of God. So the first thing that Ibn Sina, he kind of, obviously Ibn Sina comes before Al-Ghazali, so he has no chance to respond. But there is a problem here. And I'll tell you what the problem is. And it's a very, I don't want to go into too much detail, but the problem is this, is that if you say God is eternal, that means his will is eternal. And if you say God's will is eternal, then he would always have to choose whatever he has chosen. Let's start defining certain things, right? What is choice? What is irada? Okay, great. So you have a choice of two or more things and you choose one over the other. And in Arabic sometimes it's called what? Tarjih. We use it in fiqh. A qawl rajih, they say. You know, some scholars, they like, and nowadays, especially if they don't follow madhab, they'll say, this opinion is this, and this opinion is this, and the true opinion is 1, 2, 3. And the guy, he hasn't learned Arabic letters yet. And he's saying the true opinion is this and is that. No problem. So al-rajih means the approved decision, basically. So it is the choice that is made, one over the other, A over B. So the issue is, if you have an eternal God with an eternal will, and that will is always eternal, that must mean the choice is always eternal. So al-Ghazali, he responds, and he says, but that's not necessarily so. Why? Because you can God can post-date something. God has the will, has the ability to post-date something, one over the other. So for example, and he gives this example of the marriage, al-talaq al-sharti. If I say to you, and this is actually true, if I say to my wife, if you step foot outside of the house, you're divorced. Literally, if she steps foot outside of the house, then she'll become divorced. She just has to stay in the house. Or she has to decide what she wants to do. If she wants to leave, she's divorced, and she's yani. But he uses this example of the conditional divorce, at-talaq al-sharti or whatever, and he says, well, God can do the same thing. Yani, he can have a will, and then he can post-date that will to a particular time. So that's one thing. There are issues here, though, as you can probably think, I'm probably thinking now, which is that if you do say, what do you... Now we have to reinvent what we mean by God having an eternal will. Like, what does that mean? That's why Fakhruddin al-Razi, he famously said, I think in Hayat al-Aqul or al-Matalib al-Aliyah, one of the two, yeah? He famously said that you always have three issues and you will not be able to solve... by solving one, you make the other one becomes a problem. One of them is hudul al-hawadith. The other one is tasalsul, and the third one is tarjih bil-murajjah. I think, yeah. So there's three things which I'll tell you what they are. Hudul al-hawadith is the idea that God doesn't change, and you'll be surprised, but al-Razi actually admits there is no madhab, and he's an Ash'ari. There's no madhab that is deplete from some idea of hulul hawadith. Now, this might be a shock to somebody, some people. So, how can God change? We're not saying God changes. We're saying that there is some kind of renewal of God or some. Yeah, and that's what they mean by it. That's what, for example, Ibn Taymiyyah talks. He's very clear about it. Ibn Taymiyyah believes in this. he calls it tajaddud fi dhatillah, renewal in the essence of God. But Ibn Taymiyyah goes quite far in this compared to the Ash'aris, who are very conservative with this. In fact, they reject it outright. At-tasalsul is the idea of an infinite regress. And tarjih bil-murajjah is this idea that I've just said to you, and I'm approving one decision over the other. So let me explain why these three things are in tension with one another. Number one, actually let me ask you, why do you think these three things are in tension with one another? Why do you think that if you solve one of them, the other one becomes somewhat of a problem? Yes.
So, well, for the God changing issue, if God
let's call it renewal.
The renewal of God. Yeah. Sorry. All right. They might say that anything that renews itself is contingent.
Yeah.
And therefore created.
Okay.
Right. However, we understand from the Quran and Sunnah that Allah doesn't change.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to reconcile between these two things.
Okay, what in particular have we just spoken about which needs to change in order for it to be efficacious.
The will of God.
The will of God.
Right.
Because if you don't have a change in the will of God, you don't have a will being effective.
Why is that problem not solved by the post-dating?
Pardon?
Why is that problem not solved by the post-dating, if you post-date the will? Or if, like, some people say that, like in eternity, Allah willed that this thing would happen this way and this thing would happen in that way.
Yeah, and that's how the Ash'aris will solve it.
That's
how Ghazali solves it. Yeah. That's, he attempts to solve it like that. That's his way of trying to solve it.
That works, yeah.
It really depends on your articulation of it. Like, we have to go back to what we mean by eternity. And what do we mean by eternity? Yeah. Yeah.
So, does all of this mean that time does apply to God?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Because what is time, first of all?
Yeah, so...
Yeah, because the whole... If we're talking about eternity, we must first talk about what? Time. Because eternity is an expression of what?
Time.
So Al-Ghazali actually defines time. And time is defined in physics. Who knows what distance over speed, yeah. So time is distance over speed. T divided by S, yeah. But Al-Ghazali, in Tahafut al-Falasifa, he says that time is movement. Okay? And this is true. Because time is movement, because if everything stayed still, there would be no time. And that's why Ibn Taymiyyah says time doesn't actually exist in the real world. Obviously, he didn't believe in the Kuliyat. And Frank Griffel actually says, and I have to look at this and assess it, but Frank Griffel does actually mention that he thinks that Ghazali has a nominalist position as well. And there are some maqulat that seem contradictory to Ghazali, and I don't know what is the... I need to get some more information, but Griffel's opinion is that Ghazali had this same opinion. And if Ghazali has the same opinion, which is that time doesn't exist like an entity, then when we talk about eternity here, we are not talking about something which can be expressed in the real world. We are talking about the expression of movement. But then we get to what Ghazali is saying here. And this is why his attack on infinity is so important. Because Ghazali's whole point is this, that you cannot have, this is definitely his belief, you cannot have movement going on forever into the past. Do you see the point? You cannot have it. It's not something possible. Now, I'm going to explain to you why he says this. He takes from... There are people of the past like John of Philoponus and Genocides. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's a Jewish medievalist. They had these theories and these arguments that they would put forward. Before that, you had the whole Zeno... I'm sure you've heard of Zeno's paradox. Do you remember Zeno's paradox? Who can articulate it? Yes.
Was it like a string which is infinitely long? It has no like middle point.
So basically, like an arrow. But let's use another example here. You've got point A and point B. Point A and point B. Yeah. Now, in reality, if you keep halving, you can do this ad infinitum. So Zeno is asking, if there's an infinite amount of points from point A to point B, the question is, how can you traverse this? Aristotle says, he brings about this idea of an actual infinite versus a potential infinite. Zeno, because he doesn't know how to solve the problem, yeah, that's why he calls it a paradox, he says, actually, the fact that you can traverse point A to point B, this whole thing is illusory. Yani, there is actually no traversing going on here. We just assume, it's like an optical illusion almost. Aristotle says, no, actually. This is not an optical illusion. And there is an actual traversing going on from point A to point B. And you're confusing an actual infinite with a potential infinite. From this line of reasoning, Al-Ghazali agrees in many senses with Aristotle. And Al-Ghazali is saying that an actual infinity cannot exist in the real world. And he brings forward arguments to prove this point. One such argument is the rotating planets argument. He says, look, imagine if you have an infinite universe, or sorry, an eternal universe, yeah? If you have an eternal universe and the planets are rotating within them, within the universe, that would, let's say, for example, you have two planets. You have Saturn and you have the Sun. He's giving these like as example. He actually uses this example. He says the Sun, let's say, it takes 30 years to orbit itself or whatever, yeah? Pardon? Yeah, I know, but he uses the Sun. I know the Sun is not a planet, whatever. You know, and and then Saturn as well. This guy's coming in with attitude today. Huh? Yeah. And I know you're a pilot, you know, obviously, you know more about, you know, the air and all this than I the atmosphere. Have you taken off recently or something like that?
Not to the Sun, no.
Oh, okay. No. You'd be blown to smithereens if that happened. But what I was going to say is that he says the Sun, yeah, it goes, it's one revolution, it's 30 years. And Saturn, let's say it's 1 year. But if it's an eternal universe, then you have to say that there's as many revolutions of the Sun as there is of Saturn.
Because it started from the same point.
Well, it doesn't start from any point. That's the whole point. Yeah. So because it didn't start from any point, do you see? Do you get what he's saying here? Does everyone understand it? Shall I repeat this point? Let's make it one and two, just for the sake of argument. Imagine one planet it orbits itself in 1 year, and the other planet orbits itself in 2 years. So if I were to ask you how many, you got planet A and planet B, how many times has planet A orbited itself? You would say infinite times. How many times has planet B orbited itself? Infinite times. How could it be the same when the revolutions are different? He's saying that's a contradiction here. That is a contradiction. And it's a very difficult contradiction to try and resolve. And that's why John of Philoponus, he speaks of bigger and smaller infinities. Yeah, so you cannot have bigger and smaller infinities. You cannot have bigger and smaller infinities. And that's the general principle. Anything susceptible to addition or subtraction is finite. Because what is infinity? I mean, the definition of infinity is something which is boundless, that has no beginning and has no end. That's what infinity means. But then how can you add to infinity? And so, Philoponus, he says that a past events cannot be possible infinitely because the past would not be completed and the future would never have reached its place. So in other words, if there was an infinity into the past, we would never get to where we are now. And additionally, he would say, well, how can you be adding on to... So for example, if we assume there's such a thing as pre-eternity, how can we be adding on to the infinity? He says this whole thing is a contradiction. And I'm sure you guys have heard of these analogies that, you know, let's say, for example, I'm about to write something here on this piece of paper. But before I do so, I have to ask Mahdi, and then he has to ask Shakir, and then he has to, you know, Ma'ad, then he has to ask Furqan, and then it goes on forever. Would I ever write anything on the paper? No. And likewise, he says, if it was true that there was a past infinity, the universe wouldn't have started. There would be no inception of the universe. There would be no Big Bang. Let's put it in cosmological terms. Now, obviously, if someone believes in the Big Bang, this is a very good way of arguing. Because what happened before that, and what happened, then this infinite regress, I'm sure everyone's heard of it. And William Lane Craig has made a whole career out of it. You know, he's written his first book, The Cosmological Arguments and stuff like that. And he uses examples like David Hilbert's hotel example. Imagine you've got a hotel with an infinite amount of people inside. Yeah? Let's just imagine. I think he stole it from Ghazali because he definitely stole this from Ghazali, actually. I don't know why he didn't give him credit. Because Ghazali spoke about the infinite souls. He literally used the example of infinite souls. So Hilbert used the same example, but forget about souls, we put bodies as well and put them in a hotel. He modernized the example. But it's the same example. It's the one Ghazali used. David Hilbert is, if you don't know, he's one of the biggest mathematicians in the 20th century. And it should also be said that there was some resistance, that some some mathematicians did believe in an actual infinity that could exist in the real world. But then, if we're talking about the real world here, what has math got to do with it? Because math is not really talking about the real world, is it? Anyway, to be honest with you. But as I was saying, David Hilbert said, if you got a hotel with an infinite amount of people inside of it, and then you add one more, what do you have? Infinity plus one. But the proposition of infinity plus one is a contradictory one. So this is the basic argument, and I'm sure you've heard it before. Ibn Taymiyyah, as you guys know, we spoke about it last time, he didn't accept this, actually. He believed that God can be creating infinitely into the past, because Allah is al-Khalaq. And in fact, he done a whole sharh of a hadith by Imran ibn Husayn, which is, كَانَ اللَّهُ لَمْ يَكُنْ شَيْءٌ مَعَهُ كَانَ عَرْشُ عَلَى الْمَاءِ. That Allah was there and nothing was with him, and his arsh was on the water. And he says that, well, if Allah was, the arsh was in the water, this shows you that there was something with Allah. But he's hermeneutically, in reality, he's doing hermeneutics here. And if we're being honest, we can actually easily find a qawl of the Salaf from a theological perspective, which indicate the beginningness of the universe and or the beginningness of the world and the first creation. You have a qawl of Umar ibn al-Khattab himself, saying, أول من خلق القلم, and the first thing that was created was the pen. Like, all you have to do really is, you have to, look at Nun wal-Qalami wa ma yasturun, these two verses, and look at the tafsir of it, and you'll see so many different aqwal of Salaf, and you can check up the isnad of it, which they believe the beginning of the universe or something, or the beginning of the world. What and there's this dispute. Ibn Kathir mentions, is it the arsh that was the beginning? Was it the water first? Was it the pen? But this indicates that there was something first. So theologically, Ibn Taymiyyah doesn't really seem to have a robust case, to be honest with you. And Ash'ari seem to be more correct here, in terms of at least believing that the universe had a beginning. Creation ex nihilo, it certainly seemed to be theologically more correct. But is Ibn Taymiyyah, let's have a discussion. Let's say logically now, do you think Ibn Taymiyyah's view of Hawadith la awwala laha makes sense compared to these kinds of arguments? And how do you think an argument can be made against this kind of infinity? But before I ask you this question, I'll say one thing. Ibn Taymiyyah says that, just like he says, this is how he builds his argument in Dar al-Ta'arib al-Aql wal-Naql. He says, look, and he was answering al-Razi, by the way, as he does. And he was saying, because al-Razi puts forward the same argument. Al-Juwayni puts forward the same argument with Darahim or Dananir or something like that, yeah? With some coins. I remember and Ibn Taymiyyah attacks it. And it wasn't really very robust attack. He said, I can't remember, it was like, Juwayni says, if you have one coin and then before, but Ibn Taymiyyah attacks this, yeah? But Ibn Taymiyyah makes a theological case and says, you guys believe in heaven. And in heaven, you're going to have, you're going to have everlasting whatever, and you can have as much of whatever you like. أُكُلُهَا دَائِمْ وَظِلُّهَا, as the Quran says. أُكُلُهَا دَائِمْ وَظِلُّهَا, that its food is continuous, perpetual, and so is this shade, for example. So how do we, he says, if it's conceivable, Ibn Taymiyyah is saying, if it is conceivable that in the future you can have things like this in the future, eternal things, why not in the past? Now, note here with the big asterisk, Ibn Taymiyyah does not believe in infinite regress of causes. He says, بِاتِفَاقْ الْعُقَلَىٰ, with the consensus of all rational beings, this is impossible. He believes in infinite amount of things, and that Allah is the creator of each one directly. You can talk to the person next to you, what are the pros and cons, the strengths and the weaknesses, what are you most convinced with? Are you convinced more with Al-Ghazali, this might be controversial here, or Ibn Taymiyyah, or maybe Ibn Sina, and hope no one says that, because this is Kufr Akbar, Yukhri Sahibu Min Al-Millah. And I will say, obviously, I mentioned last time that Al-Ghazali made takfir of Ibn, he excommunicated Ibn Sina on four grounds. There's actually three, only three grounds. One of them is that, do you remember what the reasons were in Tahfiz al-Falasifah?
That Allah doesn't know the particulars.
Yes, that Allah la ya'lamu al-juz'iyyat. That Allah doesn't. Do you know why he believed that, by the way? Why is Ibn Sina believed that?
Earlier?
What was that?
The one can only come from one.
Okay.
It's related to that?
Yeah, it's related to that. It is related to that.
Yeah, but I don't know the.
Yeah, so this idea of an all-knowing God that knows all the particulars and stuff is, he doesn't believe in that, by the way. Some of the things that he believes, you'd be shocked, Ibn Sina. The second thing was what? Which is what we're talking about.
Eternality of
the eternality, which is in Arabic what? Qidamul alam. Yeah, qidamul alam is eternality of the world, yeah? And the third reason? Ibn Sina didn't believe that when everyone's resurrected, that the bodies will be resurrected as well, which I think was a position held by one of the heretics up north called Mufti Abu Layth. He calls himself Mufti, but isn't he? I think he took this position, but obviously he would be made takfir of by the likes of Al Ghazali on that basis. Anyway, these, yes. Yeah, because remember, he doesn't. He almost has a classical theistic picture of God. He doesn't have this personal God, or like with you can't have a personal God without will, Yanni.
Yeah.
You don't have will. God is just emanating. He is just emanating things, and it's connected to his idea of privation, by the way. And we can go into this later on. He had a very strange theodicy, but it was interesting though. Yanni, he believed, for example, what is a good thing and what is a bad thing. Do you know what he said about that? Ibn Sina said a bad thing is that which doesn't perform as function good. Not like that's Ibn Taymiyyah, more Aquinas, Ibn Taymiyyah, Augustine. The absence of, because God's good and he gives out good. For Ibn Sina is that the emanation has not been, like for example, if we take the sun and rays example, it's like it's not a perfect ray, it hasn't come out perfectly. So it's a deformed substance. No, but there is a proximity of this view with Ibn Taymiyyah's view. The only difference is that Ibn Taymiyyah does its best for the sifa, which is a huge difference, obviously, and Ibn Sina does not do that. So, for example, for Ibn Sina, a knife which is blunt is a bad knife.
Does he believe in the platonic forms then? No,
I don't think, I don't know.
How does he define what like a perfect knife is?
Say again?
How does he know what a perfect knife is?
No, I think functionally. Yeah, it's a good question. Does he believe in platonic forms exist in some... I don't know. I have to check this. I have to think about that. Yeah? But now the question I wanted to ask, what are you most convinced with of the three views? Because we have... Look, think about it. Let's do a tashjir, yeah? Let's do a logical... What's the word called? Disjunctor. Yeah? So this... what are the possibilities? The universe could have been eternal. The universe could have had a beginning. And there could have been an infinite amount of universes. This fourth idea that the universe came from nothing, is no one believes in it. Even Krauss, who wrote this book that's in the bin somewhere, or maybe in the toilet roll or something, we created it. But even he admits it's not nothing, Yanni. He admits that. So this idea that something comes from nothing, it's a nonsense idea. Like, it's not worth entertaining this. Honestly, no one has said this. Like, I want to know if there's Hellenistic philosophers, if anyone's an expert on Hellenistic philosophy, if anyone actually believed that. And if they did, how badly they would have been refuted, man. Because this is like complete, it's definitely not one of the main schools. No way, Yanni. Yeah? So, and all the way up to the medieval times, and all the way up to the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, and all the way up to our present day, Yanni. I have not come across a serious work that people talk about something coming up from nothing, or the universe coming from nothing. So, when you do a... Huh? Well, he tried to evade this point, you know. He tried to say, well, I didn't say, and I said, and I didn't say, and then he went with William Lane Craig and he said that, and they got laughed at. But yani, the idea of something coming from nothing, forget it. Yani, I'm khuluqu min ghayri shay'in wa hum al-khaliqun. Yani, it's so absurd that Allah just asked the question. He didn't even make it as a point. He didn't even refute it. He just asked the question, like, just to show you how ridiculous you are. He didn't even, yani, subhanAllah, were you created from nothing? So if you think about the three models, one is the eternal universe model, pros and cons, weaknesses and strengths, and we're looking at it just logically here. We're not looking at it theologically. And there's an importance, it's important that we do aql and naql. because we don't believe there's there is a contradiction anyway. But if we're speaking to an atheist, we need to be able to elaborate the matter in a way which is in line with their mustalahat, as Ibn Taymiyyah said. So these three models, I want you to speak to the person next to you for the next 5-10 minutes. What are the strengths and weaknesses of each? And yani, which one are you completely convinced with or most convinced with, and which one are you not convinced with? And we'll, yeah? Okay, guys, you've had some time to deliberate and to assess and to evaluate. So the three options that we had, which are the three options that were out there, and they need to be differentiated, because some people actually don't know that Hawadith La Awalalha, which is the position of Ibn Taymiyyah, was not the same as Qidamul Alam. This is a major misconception, especially within some Ash'ari circles and so on. They think it's two the same thing, and they're not. And the major difference is well, first of all, what is the major difference between the two notions? What is the difference between Hawadith La Awalalha, which Ibn Taymiyyah speaks about, and Qidamul Alam? Yes.
So Qidamul Alam, or an eternal universe,
yeah.
You have a creation that is in existence alongside Allah from pre-eternity, right? And with the Hawadith La Awalalha, you have every single thing is created in a particular time and place.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
Yeah, that's the major difference. And it's created by whom?
By Allah.
Okay, so what are the strengths and weaknesses of each of the three things? Let's start with the idea that you can have an infinite regress. Let's start with Ibn Taymiyyah's idea, right? That you can have an infinite regress of things, but Allah created each one directly. What are the strengths and weaknesses of this theory? Just from a logical perspective, not looking at the theology for now. Yeah.
We were talking about how, logically, I guess you could say it makes sense. Yeah. Nothing, no individual created thing exists eternally, but created things were being created eternally into the past. Logically, that makes sense. We were talking about whether that there is like some closet occasionism potentially here, but like, because if you say that, because he wants to say that there's things going infinitely into the past, but he can't say that there's infinite causation, because that's impossible.
That's an interesting point. So you're saying that Ibn Taymiyyah's view is anti-occasionalist when it comes to the kaun, this world, and occasionalism, just define it quickly.
That there's no primary causation.
So occasionalism is that God, like, if you think, have you ever seen these kind of old cinemas? Have you seen that?
The pictures.
What's it called? You guys are into these things.
the film tape thing.
Yeah, like one... one.
The light, where it's like a bunch of pictures.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
flashes
yeah.
Very, very quickly.
Yeah, what's that called?
Well, I don't know.
Whatever that is, yeah. So each one is not causing the other one.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, let's say you got that and you got dominoes. Dominoes, one is pushing over to the other, mm-hmm. Yeah? The tape thing is that you've got all these pictures that are being shown, but they're being projected from one source. Whereas the dominoes is that each one is knocking the other one down.
Yeah.
So Ibn Taymiyyah he can't say that one is causing the other and that's infinite. He's clear about that it's not. He's clear about that you cannot have infinite causation. So the only thing left to do is for him to say that God created things independently, but that's almost, you're saying, like taking the Ash'ari position, which is the idea that you have direct causation, and obviously they have Kasb and all that stuff. We've spoken about that in other sessions. So it's almost repudiating his own criticism of the Ash'aris, but he's changing the context and he's allowing something to happen which he does not allow in the Qawm. I think that's an interesting point of consideration, yeah. That is a very interesting point of consideration. What else would you say?
If you're saying that there's infinite creations and God created them, it seems to be contradictory, because if God created them, then God was a cause and the creations were the effect. And by definition, unless you believe like reverse causality, the effect must come before the effect must come after the cause. So an infinite number of things versus an infinite cause, I don't think would make sense in that sense.
He would say that God is continuously doing that because he's eternal. God is eternal, so he's perpetually creating. What would Ghazali say to that?
Yeah, I think Ghazali would go against the idea of actual infinite, right?
Yeah. And how, give us some examples of what kind of arguments he we said that he would use. What examples did we go through like that, that we just went through now?
Sorry, Mohammed, can I ask something?
Yeah.
You know when you said God is creating perpetually into the past?
Yes.
Right, he's creating things.
Yes.
So there must have, you know, with this argument, there must have been a first thing. You know.
No, no, even Taymiyyah would say there wasn't.
Right.
Al-Ghazali would say there must have been a first thing. That's what the tension is. And the reason why he say there would be, there has to be a first thing. What did we just cover now? What kind of arguments would they say?
Like the planets argument.
So what can you elaborate that?
Re-articulate the planet argument.
Yeah, for example.
That if you assume that you have planet A and planet B, and planet A's orbit is 1 year, planet B's orbit is 2 years. If there's an infinite amount of time in the past, then if you were to ask how many rotations each of those planets have done, then the answer would be the same, which would be infinite. Mm-hmm. That's impossible because we know that the rotations are different.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole question is I guess from a Ghazalian standpoint, is you can't have an infinite regress of, so you can't have an actually infinite number of things.
Okay, this is very important. Let me tell you the principle, and just remember this, yeah? Al-Ghazali is basically saying this. Anything susceptible to addition cannot be infinite. Anything susceptible to addition cannot be infinite. And if you're saying there's an infinite past and we're adding to it, that's a contradiction. Because if infinity is something which is boundless and has no beginning, no end, and you're adding to it, then you must reinvent what it means to be infinite for you to have your cake and eat it both. And this is a very powerful argument.
So do you mean,
yeah.
Like by time going forward, at the moment, time is going forward.
Yes.
So because time is going forward, there can't be an infinite regress of time.
Beautiful. That's exactly what he would say.
Right. Okay.
That's exactly right. He say if time is increasing now, then how can time increase? How can you increase something which is already infinite? Which something infinite means it has no increase. It has no potential for increase. So put it this way: if infinity means something has no potential for increase, and you're saying it's increasing, that's a contradiction. How can you say something has no potential for increase, yet it's being increased? Ghazali would say this is nonsense.
How does Ibn Taymiyyah define creation? Because we spoke about this one time.
Yeah, it's a good question. How does Ibn Taymiyyah define creation? Ibn Taymiyyah, it talks about ayan. A creation is not changing something into something. It's not yani crafting something from something else. It's creating something in its ayn form. It's in raw essence form. Which is why he had this big issue with alchemy. Did I mention this to you before? Because alchemy, they say, if you get a ton of gold, you cannot. They all say you can change this. I'm being crude here, but you can change this ton of gold into a ton of silver. Yeah. He said he was against it. He said you can't do that. He said how can you? Because that, and he used theological principles. He says you can't do it because only Allah can do that. You cannot change the ayn, the essence of something, from one thing to another thing.
Mm. It couldn't be said that with Allah's permission that can happen. The same way Jesus blew into the clay and it became a bird. Isn't that one ayn?
No, but Ibn Taymiyyah has a very staunch opinion against this thing. He's saying only Allah can do that. That's khalq. That's the khalq that Allah can only do. No, it's not. There's no ayns changing here.
It's not clay into a bird.
No, because the bird is already from clay. Like, yani, the bird is made from clay, just like human beings are made from clay. Put it this way, I'm no chemist. Yeah, there's about 92 elements. All 92 elements that can be found in clay can be found in a human being. Kind of thing. Yeah, it's the same elementary. Building blocks. If you analyze it, it will be the same thing. It's not, you're not changing one raw element to another. Yep.
Okay, you have like the stick of Musa and then the snake. My point is, if why is it hard for him if
Allah the stick allows is made from the same thing as the snake?
Okay.
Yeah, he would say stuff like this. Now, really? You could argue it's outdated. You could argue what he's saying is outdated.
Well, the mountain and the camel. And indicated there.
Which one?
Salih al-Islam.
What about it?
He carved a camel from a mountain, right? Then the stone turned into a camel.
It's a mu'jiza. That's the whole point.
Right, but Allah allowed it.
Yeah. But that's a mu'jiza. That is a miracle. That's something which shouldn't happen in the using the everyday laws of nature and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, Allah done it. Allah done it, yeah. For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, قَالَتْ رُسُلُهُمْ
وَمَا كَانَ لَنَا
أَنْ نَأْتِيَ بِسُلْطَانٍ إِلَّا بِإِذْنِ
اللَّهِ
بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ
وَعَلَى اللَّهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلُوا.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, we cannot bring any sultan except with anything that the Prophet comes with anyway is from Allah. But he's saying that the act of creation, you could argue it's outdated, but just to answer the question, he had a view. I think Ibn al-Qayyim had a view on it, a book on it, about alchemy and stuff like that. Yeah, he had this whole thing. You get it? You can disagree with it. Maybe now with quantum physics, you can say this is all, nonsense, but it's, needs to be updated. Someone needs to come and speak about it in different terms now. Quarks and this and that. You can strings and I don't know how you're going to do it. But let's go back to the point. Infinity. It's. There was a guy called Democritus in Hellenistic period. The idea is if you keep breaking, and he made it's called atomism. If you keep breaking something, have you heard of this? Okay, who wants to articulate what's atomism?
Heard of it. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, if you keep breaking something down, there has to be these simples. These simples, like, if I have, like, for example, a rock, and I keep smashing it into two, or breaking it, cutting it into two, whatever, yeah? He say, this idea of atomism is that there has to be something, simple thing, which it goes down, breaks down to. And that's why these old mutakallimun, they call this al-jawhar al-fard. The indivisible atom. This is the raw building blocks of materials and creation and stuff like that. But the idea of it being going on forever would nullify. This is the example of one argument that Ibn Taymiyyah was fully against. Would nullify the existence of anything. How can you keep going, Yani? So this idea of using infinity to disprove the impossibility of an infinite regress of things is probably the most powerful and used way of proving God's existence. However, I'll be honest, on a practical level, it can be very tedious for people just to hear this stuff. Boring, actually. Very boring. I've seen debates, atheist debates, that you make your initial argument, because Ibn al-Ghazali made his argument, everything that kullu shay'in lahu bidayah lahu sabab, everything that has a beginning has a cause, al-alamu lahu bidayah, the universe had a beginning, isn't al-alamu lahu sabab, therefore the universe had a cause. And then you can't have an infinite regress, therefore the cause must be one, all these kinds of things. That's basically the argument. But then, because there's two or three stages of the argument here which are problematic. Al-Ghazali, when he says kullu shay'in lahu bidayah lahu sabab, it's not problematic, but it will open a can of worms. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. This is William Lane Craig, 101, yeah? Everything, and he took this from, Al-Iqtisad fil I'tiqad, yeah? Everything that has a beginning has a cause. What can someone say?
The universe has no beginning.
The universe, that's more the second premise, yeah? They'll say, well, we don't really believe in causation. So there's you got the word causation here, or what is causation, or what about retrocausation? All these questions, yeah. Second premise, al-alamu lahu bidayah, the universe had a beginning. That's where the ta'an is. So we don't believe in we don't believe in the Big Bang. Nowadays, people have taken a U-turn from the Big Bang. I saw recently a thing with William Lane Craig and Penrose. William Lane Craig used to use Roger Penrose as a way to describe the fine-tuning of the universe. Roger Penrose is seen as one of the top physicists in this century, yeah? And he's moved from believing that the universe had a beginning, the Big Bang Theory, to believing a kind of expansion model. So the issue is, and this is the thing, William Lane Craig, for example, in order to show the veracity of his belief system, to save this argument, the second premise is the one that gets the most attack. So, for example, you now have to become a scientist. You have to engage, think of it this way. If you want to go down this route, you actually have to know the science pretty well. Like, for example, William Lane Craig, although his background is philosophy of religion, yeah, if you look at his book on, like, he's written a book, I think, called something Eternity or something like that, where he literally goes into the science. He talks about theory of relativity and different understandings of it, and he tries to prove the Big Bang, and he's going with it, and he has to go. So if you really want to go into this line of argumentation, you have to be a master of, to be honest, you should do a physics degree, or you should do at least half physics degree, or you should do something. If you like this argument and you want to use it on the highest level, you have to be a good physicist, a good cosmologist. Otherwise, I think it will be lackluster, it will be kind of weak, it will be shallow. At the very least, you have to immerse yourself in the literature of cosmology. But the issue is, cosmology is a changing science. So even if you do all of that, and then 10 years from now, 100 years from now, Roger Penrose or his son, or whoever it may be, decides that, you know, actually this redshift thing, that we interpret in another way. Because as we've said in many times here, this is where the philosophy of science becomes very pertinent. You have, you know, the underdetermination. You have the problem of induction, all these things. Underdetermination, which is the idea that you can interpret the variables in more than one way. This stuff is not going to actually go away, and especially with cosmology. Cosmology, especially with quantum physics. This is the main reason, because people ask me, why are you going with the other, like the contingency argument, where you're not going with this standard argument? This is the main reason. Because I don't want to have to use a scientific theory as one of the main talking points for something which is meant to be timeless. Because especially a scientific theory which has already undergone considerable level changes and has been volatile. Yeah. Physics has been certainly volatile in the last 100 years. This is the main reason. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. Causation, to be honest with you, I feel like you can win the arguments easily. Causation seems to be the foundational thing. If someone denies causation, you can say whatever. You know, you don't actually deny it, do you? Like if someone tried to kill your mum, and then you went into the thing and you said, what's the probable cause? He said, no, I don't believe in causation, Your Honor. Why did you slap him? It's a probable cause. Nah, there's no such thing. Causation. Most people believe in causation as a matter of fact, axiomatically. Yani. But the second premise of the argument, you need to be really good at physics. And even if you are, there's the problem of physics changing. So that's where the fight is. There's two. If you want to use Ghazali's argument, by all means. But you need to know where the fight is. It's like every argument, it starts off a certain way. And then the tussle happens somewhere. It's much easier, and Ibn Taymiyyah said this in Sharh Aqid al-Isfahaniyah, he says, it's much easier to speak of these things. He said, it's going around a contingency. It's long, he said. He goes, I'd rather speak about it just in terms of hadith. He said that. He agrees with Ghazali in many ways, even though not on infinity, but on the idea of just starting from causation, hadith and stuff. He agrees with him on that. However, as I'm saying here, you're going to have to spend a lot of time justifying. It'll be easier for you to make the argument, but longer for you to defend it. Whereas with the contingency argument, it's longer to make the argument, but much easier to defend it. That, I know that's simplistic, but that's what I think it is. Spend a little bit more time laying everything out, and if the interlocutor comes and says, well, I actually don't, and this comes all about now, like, if you speak to atheists, they'll say, well, I don't know if the universe did have a beginning, actually, because they know where we're going. They've heard it all before. I don't know if the universe did have a good. What about if the universe is oscillating and it's like a balloon, it's just like whatever. What if this, what if that, what if this, what if that? What if, you know, what, you know, but you're going to have gone to a scientific discussion now? No, about this and infinity and... one thing that William Lane Craig does actually do is he actually uses the infinity thing to show that the universe had a beginning. Which is something you're welcome to do as well. It's impossible the universe was always there, because if it was always there, and use the same arguments.
Yeah, so in that case, can we say that he's not making a scientific theory, now he's making a logical theory?
Say again?
So if he's using the argument against infinity to show the beginning of the universe, could you now say that William Lane Craig is making a purely logical argument?
Yeah, that's what he does actually mention that point. At one point, in fact, I can't remember where, but he says that. Yes, he makes both, though. He does actually engage with the science. But I think maybe you could argue that he's engaging with the science as supplementary type of thing. But he's saying, yes, I'm doing this thing. Just basically, if you defeat the infinite regress, you have the beginning of the universe. So you could decide to just go with this. But you just have to be ready for all of the counter arguments and stuff like that. I don't think this is as timeless as the contingency argument, and I don't think it's bulletproof. That's the reason why I don't use it as much. Not because I don't believe in it, by the way. I believe in the whole thing. I believe in the whole thing. To be honest with you, I believe in the whole thing. But it's not about me believing it. It's about me proving it. I say, this guy's jealous of me. I believe it, but I can't prove it. You know, there's lots of things we believe and, you know, we can't prove. So that's that. Any questions now before we end? Before we end, let me ask you guys a question, just to make sure. How would you, using Al-Ghazali's ways, how would you nullify the idea of an infinite universe or an internal universe? Using Al-Ghazali's arguments against infinite regress of things, how would you use that to try and nullify the idea of an eternal universe?
Can we just use that line you said?
Yes.
Anything that's susceptible to addition cannot be infinite.
Beautiful, perfect. So you start with that. Just remember that. Anything that's susceptible to addition cannot be infinite. If there's addition to the universe, whether it's in time, whether it's in space, whether it's in anything, then it's not infinite. You can say that stuff. Yeah, you can. Yeah, and you can talk about it, you know, the fact that we have, if they believe in the Big Bang, well, like, that's a big thing. To be honest with you, if someone says to me, and you might want to make a decision, like, if someone says, you have to be pragmatic about this situation. If someone says to you, I believe in the Big Bang theory, I actually believe in it, the redshift and all that stuff, then this is probably the best argument to use, to be honest. How sure are you of the Big Bang? No, I'm sure, I'm 100% sure. Okay, so the universe had a beginning. Do you agree that everything that we get, you can say it, everything that has a beginning has a cause and so on, and make the argument. So you decide, look, these arguments are just like tools in your bag. Sometimes you need to use a screwdriver, sometimes you use a hammer, sometimes you need this one, you need that one. And you might feel comfortable using certain arguments and not other arguments. You might feel like, you know what, I just feel comfortable with this argument. There's no right and wrong answer here. The contingency argument is correct. This argument is correct. It's just it's the burden of proof. It's how skeptical is the person going to look in front of you? How much time are you going to... You have to think about all these variables. Yes?
I've heard many atheists say that the thing that caused the Big Bang is eternal.
That's it, perfect. You believe in God, yeah? that's it. If they say that, then that's all we wanted to hear from him.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what we're saying as well. The thing that caused the Big Bang is eternal. I concur. You know, that's the whole point. That's what we're trying to say to you. That's the point. But you'll see there's a thread, there's a line that joins all of these arguments. The composition argument, what is the thread that joins all these arguments? The Tarkib argument that we spoke about before, and this argument of... Because I want to show you something here, which I think is very fascinating, actually. Okay, you know, I don't want to give it away, but... What is the thread? First question. What is the thread that joins Tarkib argument with the arguments against an infinite regress? What's the commonality between the two notions? What is in common between Tarkib and the arguments against an infinite regress?
Like, as in, if you've got Tarkib, things which are composed, so they've got parts. And then with the infinite regress, that chain has got individual things that are.
Yeah, okay. So what is in common? What is the argument? What is one argument that can be made which will encapsulate both of those arguments?
Something that's contingent can't be eternal.
Okay, but think about something else. Not necessarily. Okay, think, what is tarkib? Let's just break this down. Tarkib, composition. So what do we say? Anything that is made out of parts, and what do we say parts are?
Something subtractible to subtraction and addition.
Okay, you can say that. Yeah, that's from an ontological perspective. You see? So, if we say something that is susceptible to addition or subtraction, or let's just say addition for the sake of argument, that's the thread that joins it. The thread that joins tarkib and the infinite regress, the anti-infinite regress arguments, both of them, there's a robust focus on limitation. Anything which is can be proven not to be unlimited is contingent. Basically, anything which can be proven not to be unlimited is dependent, is contingent, is caused. Fill in the blanks. It's not God, yani. Because God is all those things, yani. So, and you can't have a world with only those things. Therefore, you need a thing like the necessary being or the God or whatever. And you know who actually puts this in a very nice formulation? We haven't mentioned his name enough here. Hamza Zulsis. Where's his book? Is his book here somewhere? He says it very interestingly in his book, Divine Reality. He says anything with limited variables is dependent. Anything with limited variables. That's the idea. Tarkib is saying anything with limited variables is dependent. The anti-infinite regress arguments are saying anything with limited variable. You can't. You're saying it's showing you how there cannot be something with unlimited variables. So they actually work hand in hand. All these arguments, there's a point where it all coalesces together. That there's a need for the unlimited. There's a need for the infinite. Yet everything we assess is finite. That's it. There's a need for the infinite. There's a need for the unlimited. However, everything we are looking at or can assess or can scrutinize is limited. Therefore, you know, you need the necessary being, you need the uncaused cause, you need the first mover, all these kinds of things.
Another question. You know Ghazali's argument, where he says like something that's susceptible to, if you add to it, then it's not infinite anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So, is he merely talking about time here?
No, he's talking about anything. That's why he gives examples of like the rotating planets and stuff like that.
But that's in relation to time, right?
Yeah, in relation to time, but he gave the example of the infinite souls.
Okay, yeah.
He gave more than one example. There's another example that was given about lunar and solar eclipses. I'm not sure if you've seen that one, which is like, if you say there's an infinite universe, then you'd have to say the amount of lunar eclipses is the same as the amount of solar eclipses, which is absurd. These are strong arguments. I've not seen an undercutter to these arguments. I mean, the debates are online, and the one who has championed this line of argumentation is William Lane Craig. And he is faced, and I would dare say, except for Sean Carroll, who was the only one who defeated him, he has beaten everybody in a debate that he has used this argument. He spoke to everybody, and he defeated everyone except for Sean Carroll. And you could argue rhetorically, Christopher Hitchens, even though Christopher Hitchens was defeated logically, but rhetorically he was more, you know, he's more charismatic, yani, and that probably saved him from humiliation. But yani, this argument has been out and in use since 1979, and now it's 2022. And that's when the first edition of the book, Kalam Cosmological Argument, not my one, because my one has an S at the end of it, Kalam Cosmological Arguments, because I was trying to show that, you know, there's many of them, there's many arguments here. but his one, 1970, because I wasn't born then, you know. But 1979, his book, until now, he's been using these things. And I always say, so isn't it so interesting that he's using, you know, Ghazali's arguments to promote Christianity? He's using the arguments of a Muslim man to defend his religion. Anyway, You guys understand how the infinity arguments work now, because they're very important. I just want to do one quick thing before we finish, which is about particularization. Takhsis. Who remembers what takhsis is and how Al-Ghazali makes this argument, or how the Ash'aris in general makes this argument? Yeah.
That, say for example, I don't know, this phone is the way it is, like it has certain things about it, the brown cover, screen is cracked in certain places, things like that. but it obviously could not be like that. I could have not dropped it, the screen could not be cracked, the case could be blue, purple, whatever it is. So the fact that it is one way rather than another way, that has to be explained, as in, if you have two contingent outcomes, why is one preferred over another? And so he says that Allah, basically you need a mukhassis, you need somebody that, or something, or some external agent that specifies or selects one of those potential outcomes over another.
Absolutely. Now there is a criticism one can make of this, of Al-Ghazali and other Ash'aris, of takhsis. What do you think the criticism is? Not necessarily. To do with the will of God.
If it was always ruled that way, then...
then what? It would be necessary, process, right?
Yeah.
Do you see the point?
So if it's always ruled that way, then there was no need to
choose. Yeah, if it was always... yeah, that. However, the...
In of itself, it's a contingent,
but yeah,
as it's connected to
the... yeah, good. So that's how we've solved it. We say that in abstraction, by itself, it's not... you cannot argue it is necessary, but only in relation to the necessary existence is necessary, basically. But it's contingent in and of itself. But when we say this could have been another way, the Ash'aris are very clear that when we say mumkin, it's not just that it could be one way or not another, but it's that it's what? What is mumkin? It's generatable or destructible. It has the potential for generatability and destructibility. That it can be destroyed, it can be generated. Now, obviously, someone will say, well, energy cannot be created or destroyed. But you can reformulate the argument, which is to say it can be destroyed as in its present form. Yani, this can be completely changed to something which it isn't. I can change this thing to something completely different. I can evaporate it, I can put it in acid, you know. Yeah, I can end it. Or, even better, there was a time where this didn't exist at all. You know. So, and then you've got other arguments of change and stuff like that, which we've spoken about before in the past. But this is important, because this argument of takhsis, it establishes the will of God. It's a good argument for establishing the will of God. Why is it? There has to be an external sorting agent that... why is something A not B, C not D, whatever? It's because something has chosen. There's tarjih. There's some approval going on. There's got to be this way, not that way. Okay, so these are the arguments. Any other questions before we end? Okay, well, these are the main arguments. We've covered them. And I hope you guys have enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been mentally stimulating. And in the next session, we're going to move on completely from Kalam and stuff like that, something completely different. But we've done three sessions here on this tradition stuff, and now we're going to move on to something completely different, talking about political issues and like any completely different topics. And on this bombshell, as what's his name used to say in the Top Gear, we'll end the show. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.